What the White House has to say about where this economy is going, we'll tell you about that. What small businesses have to say about the same thing, where they think this economy is going, and a history of tipping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 9th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today in Washington. No, not that story. A different one. One where the likely outcome is not already known. Namely, what is going to happen in this economy? President Biden, Treasury Secretary Yellen, and a couple of big-name CEOs, including J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon and Sonia Singhal from Gap, had a confab in the Oval Office. Today, the president's economic relief plan, of course, was the topic at hand. Bharat Ramamurthy is the deputy director of the National Economic Council at the White House. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the news of the day, shall we? The meeting in the Oval Office today between President Biden and Secretary Yellen and some big business CEOs. The head of the Chamber of Commerce was there, Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase. What is the president trying to do getting big business lined up behind him and this relief plan?
Well, I think that he is looking for their support for the bill and for their acknowledgement that we need to go big in this moment. I think what the president is hearing from his top economic advisors is that we are at a precarious moment. Just last week, the jobs report came out and showed that job growth is really stalling in America, even though we're about 10 million jobs short of where we were pre-pandemic. And so from Secretary Yellen down to his other economic advisors, there is a uniform belief that we need to go big. We need to fundamentally alter the trajectory of the recovery, and we need to make sure that we're putting money behind putting vaccines in people's arms, because the fastest way to get the economy moving again is to make sure that we beat COVID.
Totally agree with the vaccine being this economy right now. I cannot and will not argue with that. But I do want to ask you about this idea of going big. As you know, there's some consternation by some that maybe $1.9 trillion is too much, that it is, in fact, more than the economy needs, given where, for example, the Congressional Budget Office says we're going to be this summer. Where'd you get $1.9 trillion, and is that too much?
No, we don't believe it's too much. And so I want to talk a little bit about the process by which the president and his team put this package together. I would describe it as a bottom-up process. So, for example, there are nearly 7 million Americans who are behind on their rent and at risk of eviction. We need to provide rental assistance to those people, and the package provides the amount of rental assistance needed to make sure we keep them in their homes. From Secretary Yellen to other top economic advisors, the view is we are in an asymmetric risk situation. And by that, I mean the risks of going too small with this package far outweigh the risks of going too big. So when we add that all up, I think the president is very comfortable with the size of the American Rescue Plan. And I think the American people agree with him, because there's something like 70% support for the package among the public.
Let's talk about the flip side of going too small, which is the concern the president has. One of the concerns about going too big is that there may be some inflation coming in this economy with so much money coming in so soon, and with the pent-up demand that is sure to happen once people can go out and spend and travel and enjoy life again. Are you not worried about that?
Well, look, we're monitoring all sorts of different risks to the economy, and Secretary Yellen and others have made clear that they're carefully monitoring the risk of inflation. The issue is that if you do too little, that means that people are going to go hungry. It means that people are going to be booted out of their homes in the middle of a pandemic. And those are just not acceptable outcomes to the president. And look, we are far below the Fed's inflation target and have been for a very, very long time. And not to get too wonky, but I think I think that the Chair Powell and others have said that the goal is actually to increase inflation to get closer to that 2% target that they have. We're a long ways off from that.
I wonder how, given the makeup of the president's economic team, many of whom were around in 2008 and 2009, how scarred people are by the prospect of going too small with a relief bill.
Well, I can't speak for others, and I was not personally there in 2008 and 2009, but I do think that there is an assessment of the latest and best economic evidence you look at where interest rates have been, how they have been low for an extended period of time, and you weigh the costs and the risks of adding to the deficit. And I think it very clearly comes out in favor of going big.
Let me pick up on something you just said, because it struck me when the president said something similar a number of weeks ago, that he is taking a page from the Republicans' playbook. He's saying, look, we have to borrow. We have to do deficit spending. It doesn't matter how we pay for it. And I maybe you don't know this. Maybe you weren't in those conversations. But how did he come around to, you know what, we're going to borrow the money. The heck with it.
Well, I think, again, he and his team have been deep into the economic evidence. And I think over the last 5 or 10 years, the economic evidence in support of more robust deficit financing, particularly for temporary emergency measures such as this one, is pretty airtight. The president has been clear that when it comes to permanent changes in policy, in other words, policy that involves spending each and every year for the foreseeable future, that he does think that that should be offset with new tax increases on the wealthy and on big corporations. So, and again, I think that is a view that is backed up by the best economic evidence.
Bharat Ramamurthy, he's the deputy director of the National Economic Council at the Biden White House. Mr. Ramamurthy, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, a little bouncing around, some choppiness, eventually signifying not much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You have elections. Policies change. That's the way it works. Elections have consequences is another way to say that. And the policy in question today is net neutrality, specifically the Biden administration withdrawing from a Trump-era lawsuit that was trying to overturn California's internet regulations. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains that one.
As a refresher, the net neutrality debate is about whether internet service providers can give special treatment to one kind of internet traffic over another. The Obama administration said no, the Trump administration said yes, and that wasn't even the first round. Gigi Sohn is a fellow at the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy.
And this ping pong game has now been going on since 2002.
California lawmakers didn't agree with the Trump administration's position, so the state set its own policy. Brent Skorup at the Mercatus Center says the goal was to undermine the federal rules.
In the short term, California's rules could serve as a de facto net neutrality policy for the nation. And I think that's intentional. You see California doing this in other areas like emissions testing.
That's why the Trump administration decided to fight the California law. Now the Biden administration is dropping that challenge, but that doesn't mean it's over, says Samir Jain, policy director at the Center for Democracy and Technology.
The lawsuit is actually going to continue because in addition to the Trump administration, previously the industry groups had sued to stop the California statute. So that part of the suit still is ongoing.
But that probably won't matter much, says Georgetown's Gigi Sohn. She expects
that the Biden FCC will restore net neutrality and also restore its authority over the broadband industry.
The only real long-term resolution may be if Congress, rather than one of the agencies, makes a final decision. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's a new study out that puts a different kind of price tag on the economic benefits of our current energy infrastructure, which is to say, for now, fossil fuels, oil and gas and coal. We get modern transportation out of it. We get electricity and heating. It's a lot of benefits. But there are a lot of costs, too, to be sure, often tallied in dollars and cents and increasingly in climate costs. And consider this, 8.7 million premature deaths every year globally from air pollution from coal plants and tailpipes. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the details and the economic policy implications.
8.7 million premature deaths from fossil fuel pollution. The study from the journal Environmental Research notes that's double previous estimates.
I don't think we were necessarily anticipating an estimate as high as we did.
Study co-author Eloise Murray researches air pollution at University College London. She says diesel trucks, gas cars, and coal plants spit out tiny particles, often called soot, that we inhale. And those particles hang out in the atmosphere.
Up to 1 to 2 weeks. As a result of this persistence, they can also be transported long distances. So you may not live next door to a power plant, but you can still be impacted by it.
For instance, Marie says people in the UK can inhale pollutants from continental Europe. Co-author Joel Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist at Harvard, says scientists knew this soot was deadly, and now they know even a little bit in the atmosphere can kill.
So once we did studies at lower concentrations, we discovered, whoa, the effects are larger.
These revelations should resonate with governments considering fossil fuel investments, says economist Gernot Wagner at NYU.
We are doing lots of things to avoid deaths from COVID-19. One of the worst things we could be doing is stimulating our economy with measures that then lead to more deaths on the fossil fuel front.
To him, the better policy is green energy. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you have somehow yet not heard it, might I recommend the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow morning, David Brancaccio and the gang on the early shift. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. Coming up.
I want it to be fair to everyone, including me.
As they say, all is fair in love and vaccine wars. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, little change today. Shaved off 9 points, closed at 31,375. NASDAQ tacked on about 20, a tenth or so percent. 14,007. The S&P 500 subtracted 4 points. It's kind of a wash, 39 and 11 there. Hanes Brands reported strong quarterly earnings boosted by sales of outerwear and its Champion brand. Hanes added nearly 25% today. Hanes, by the way, based in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, employs about 65,000 people around the world. The mall operator Simon Property Group sounded kind of optimistic about 2021 in a call with analysts yesterday, said it expects a recovery in occupancy and rent collection rates. Today, shares up 3.6%. A couple of media reports say most workers at San Francisco's biggest private employer, that'd be Salesforce, are going to work remotely at least part-time after this is all said and done. The pandemic company operates the city's tallest building. You might know that, Salesforce Tower. Shares, though, went the other way, dipped 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we said when we got going today, President Biden met with the CEOs of some of this economy's biggest businesses today, alongside the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as well, which, to make the turn here, the Chamber of Commerce does represent big businesses, yes, but also small ones, too. And those small businesses, well, they are not feeling it right now. According to the National Federation of Independent Business, small business optimism has dropped to an 8-month low. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that story.
For many small business owners, uncertainty is a big driver of pessimism about the rate of the vaccine rollout, the scale of the relief package, and how long it'll take consumer spending to recover. It's also about the small things a survey can't capture. Dennis Archer Jr. owns Central Kitchen and Bar.
We chose our location in downtown Detroit's First National Building because there are about 4,000 employees going there every day. I don't know if there are ever going to be people going back into the building again.
These kinds of doubts keep businesses from growing, even if they have the resources to. More than 60% of small business owners surveyed by the National Federation of Independent Business say they're not interested in a loan. David Audridge is a professor of economic development at Indiana University.
They're not sure which way to go. They're not sure which investments to make. So they stay frozen.
And pessimistic. But there are some numbers in the survey that show hope. More than half of business owners were hiring last month. About the same number plan to spend money on things like equipment and vehicles. But that was mostly in certain types of small businesses, like manufacturing and construction. Bill Dunkelberg is an economist at NFIB.
Those industries are just sailing along really well. They can't find the workers they need. They could grow more.
He thinks optimism, especially for businesses like restaurants and retail, will continue to trend down because a lot of business owners aren't confident the new normal is around the corner, and they definitely don't know what it'll look like.
I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We talked about a report from the Congressional Budget Office on the program yesterday. It was on the minimum wage, that report, and what it would mean economically to raise it to $15 an hour. About 1 million fewer people living in poverty, but also about 1.5 million fewer jobs was one of the key takeaways. Now, whether an increase is going to wind up in the next relief bill is, of course, still up in the air. But for now, the Dems are pushing it. And if it happens, among many other workers, waiters, bartenders, and others who get tipped income would be covered. And it'd get rid of the national tipped minimum wage, too, which right now is just $2.13 an hour. Not a typo there, $2.13 an hour. The idea has been, for years now, that people would make up the difference in tips. But where did that idea come from in the first place, do you suppose? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has the answer.
If you have ever waited tables, you might have experienced this feeling of dread. Tourists walk in from a part of the world like, say, Europe, where tipping is not the norm. Which is funny, because experts say tipping actually started in Europe among aristocrats and got picked up by Americans by the mid-1800s. Gerald Friedman is an economist at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst.
Rich Americans started going to Europe and coming back with this sense that, oh, we're going to be aristocrats now. And it was a mark that you had been to Europe that you were tipping. Oh, I'm going to tip because that's what we do in Paris.
Strong labor unions in Europe eventually rejected tipping, he says. But in the U.S., the end of slavery actually cemented the practice of tipping in American culture. Saru Jayaraman is the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. She says companies didn't want to reach into their own pockets to pay recently freed enslaved people.
Train companies hired tens of thousands of Black men, had them work as porters on the trains for no wage, just to live off the tips of the white customers who were traveling. The second industry was the restaurant industry that wanted the right to hire Black people and also not pay them.
Which, she says, left these workers at the mercy of people who may not have actually tipped. So some continued to work for next to nothing at times. There was pushback to the tipping system. It was often called un-American. In 1915, some states banned tipping, but those laws were quickly repealed. A federal minimum wage passed in the 1930s. Here's FDR talking about wages.
What we'll attempt to give to the industrial workers of the country, a more fair wage return.
But notice how he says industrial workers. Tipped workers weren't discussed when it came to wages. Reverend William Barber is the president of the nonprofit Repairers of the Breach. He says in part they were left out because
the powerful forces in the South wanted to make sure Black people and Latinos and others did not have the same equal economic status as white workers.
30 years later, after mounting pressure from civil rights activists, many whom themselves were Black workers making extremely low wages, Congress finally did set a standard for tipped workers. Employers would have to pay around half the minimum wage and kick in more if the tips didn't make up the difference. The tipped minimum wage stayed pegged to the regular minimum wage until 1996.
A minimum wage increase jeopardizes existing jobs.
That's Herman Cain, who would become the head of the National Restaurant Association, testifying against a proposal to raise wages. Labor historians say Cain helped push for a compromise. The minimum wage would rise, but the standard for tipped workers would no longer be tied to it. So the tipped minimum stayed at $2.13 and has been there for more than 25 years. Mike Watley is the vice president for state and local affairs at the National Restaurant Association.
Now is not a time for a massive increase in labor costs for restaurants, but especially upending a system that works for everyone right now.
But how well it works depends on who you are. Several studies have shown that Latinx and Black tipped workers make significantly less than their white counterparts. Reverend Barber says following a year of racial upheaval, it's time to do away with a practice rooted in slavery.
If you're going to address racism, first of all, you must address racism with an economic lens as well.
Seven states already require companies to pay all workers the standard minimum wage, but change on the federal level, that's still being debated. It has been for over 100 years. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Who gets a vaccine and how soon is arguably the public health and the economic question right now. There is no uniform system. States are handling it however they want to handle it. In some places, hospitals are still leading the way on vaccines, first with healthcare workers, now with seniors. But as Blake Farmer reports from WPLN in Nashville, not everybody's real happy with the way things are going.
Coast to coast, millions of seniors are still trying to find the quickest way to get the life-saving COVID vaccine. People like Peggy Burgess of Nashville. She's in her 80s. She heard that a few neighbors who are patients of the local Ascension system, St. Thomas Health, were able to get their shots through their affiliated doctors. But when she called her doctor, initially she was told she didn't qualify.
Even though their offices are there at that medical office building, that doesn't mean that they are St. Thomas doctors.
Burgess didn't think too much of it, but the roadblock she hit has actually become a point of contention in several states between public health officials and hospital systems. In Tennessee, many hospitals got a lot more vaccine than they needed for their staff members, so state health officials said they could give it to their older patients. But then people started to complain about being at a disadvantage just because they don't have the right doctor.
You're not going to see me walking down the street with a sign that says, "Who got my vaccine?" I want it to be fair to everyone, including me.
With enough phone calls, Burgess did get her vaccine through the hospital, which confirms it was limiting vaccinations to existing patients. Turns out one of her specialists is affiliated. There are reports of hospitals in Florida also giving first dibs to their patients. In Louisiana, the state health officer, Dr. Joseph Cantor, warned hospitals and clinics in strong terms. He called giving preference to existing patients discrimination and said the practice had to immediately cease or there could be financial penalties. In Tennessee, the state's health commissioner, Dr. Lisa Piercy, has been rethinking whether hospitals are the best setting to offer vaccines, especially since equity has been a stated goal.
We do not want to put up any barriers whatsoever. And I mean, there could be some substantial barriers for community members going to a hospital if they think they're going to get charged or if they have an outstanding balance there. They're like, well, I'm not going to go there. They might make me pay my bill.
Piercy's now informed Tennessee hospitals that they will have to welcome all comers to get any more vaccine. She's also instructed hospitals to consider setting up a community site accessible by public transportation.
Going forward, if you want to continue being a site that gets vaccine, you're going to have to step up for the community.
But hospitals in Tennessee have also been informed they're not going to get much vaccine anyway. Rather, local health departments have taken the lead. And instead of hospitals, nonprofit clinics and rural pharmacies are now getting doses. Nationwide, the Biden administration is beginning to ship doses to pharmacies in order to make the vaccination rollout more equitable. However, hospitals in Tennessee are feeling unfairly sidelined, says Dr. Wendy Long. She represents the State Association of Hospitals and says they're uniquely positioned to help.
The majority of hospitals view it as part of their responsibility to the community, to be a part of the vaccination effort and want to be. But they also are just looking for some clear direction.
Long says they would be happy to run community vaccination sites if public health officials would just provide an adequate supply of vaccine. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a nod to the way that markets can work in funny ways sometimes. Reddit has, of course, been in the spotlight lately at the center of the GameStop trading frenzy. GameStop shares today, by the way, if I could do a little sidebar here, down another 16% to $50 a share, 5-0. The high, if I remember right, was like in the upper 400s or something. Anyway, Reddit, which is still privately held, is making some hay while the sun shines. The company announced yesterday it has raised a new round of investment that values it at $6 billion. Never hurts to raise money when there is an opportunity to do so, CEO Steve Huffman said. And then he went on, and Reddit had a strong year. All right, we got to go, but here's your Tuesday moment of economic context. It's more curiosity, I guess, than anything else. We mentioned real quickly yesterday in the numbers that Tesla, Elon Musk's electric car company, had disclosed in a filing with the SEC that it had bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. Since then, the cryptocurrency has gone from $39,000 per Bitcoin to, one day later, $47,000. Somebody please help me make sense of that, huh? Our digital and on-demand team is Ufukme Matolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.